context, Caroline Casey. So today, and increasingly all around now as a benefit bestowed upon us humans, Saturn quintiles Uranus, which means our dedication is our freedom. Our dedication to community well-being is our freedom. There we go. And our guest wonderfully embodies that. But first, a little announcement. So Beltane virtual gathering will be May 2nd, 3 p.m. Pacific time, 6 p.m. East Coast time, with Sean Patrick O'Donoghue and me, open to all by donation. More details soon, assembling even now at coyotenetworknews.com. And it's the launch of our 8-week council, Celtic Trickster, Plants and Planets, Beltane to Summer Solstice, Courtship to Wedding. Again, details more soon to enroll, coyotenetworknews.com. So we welcome the return of Dr. Karen Gedney, author of 30 Years Behind Bars. We did an amazing show October 21st, 2021, on that 30 Years Behind Bars as prison physician, mentor, guide, all-around culture doctor, shifting the prison paradigm to one of healing and reintegration. And what she just wrote, and I'm just going to read it because it's from your email, Karen, and it's our whole show. It's really great. Karen says, the last time we talked, I've become more involved in prison reform and aging well. Now I'm involved with Return Strong, a nonprofit put together by a female union organizer for the families of the incarcerated and the incarcerated. I'm also involved with NPEP, Nevada Prison Education Project, a group trying to get college education into the prison with the Pell Grants coming. We see them coming. Plus helping federal defenders with death row cases. I'm also getting into the world of aging gracefully and gratefully and giving talks on rewire and refire. Last month, she says, I spoke at a women's health retreat in Costa Rica for my 77-year-old friend Maria, who is a bikini competitor, a personal trainer, and now an event planner. I have to say it's interesting working with women who are interested in helping society improve, get healthier, and become safer. So welcome, Dr. Karen Gedney.
Well, thank you for having me back.
It is a great gift to the community, really. You are so dreeing your weird. It's a wonderful Celtic phrase that means to play your role in destiny, power of the woman storyteller. And then I just wanted to offer you something I've been working with, proffered by my collaborator on upcoming council on Mars and testosterone. And he said there's a lot of natural sources for testosterone, primarily pine bark. And this would be useful to your women too. He said pine bark tea is a really benign form of testosterone that really helps muscles. And I go, oh, that's great. And as Diana Beresford Kroger says, you know, walk into a pine forest, you always come out smarter because of the aerosols, and smarter and stronger. And then Sean said, and I'm working with this a lot and I want to toss it to you, he said, testosterone is not intrinsically aggressive. It just woofifies whatever social game one is engaged in. If one is engaged in a game that rewards aggression and violence, one will become more aggressive and violent. But he said, but if you give testosterone to Tibetan Buddhists, they're like, more peace, more peace. So what I derive from that and want to toss to you is, so then our task is to transform the game, right? And that's, you know, what we reward in culture. And that's a great deal of what you're engaged in, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I have to say, I'm not that familiar with pine bark as a testosterone source, but certainly I feel that hormones, which fluctuate in adults and especially as they age, and for women in particular with menopause, that replacing hormones, especially with bioidentical hormones, I know for myself when I took these anti-aging and regenerative medicine type of certification, and which was like a year-long course to get the certification, those were things I never learned in medical school or residency, right, or anything. So it's always sort of interesting. Same thing with nutrition. I never had one talk on nutrition in all my training. And what I found in the unfortunate medical world is they really trained you to take care of the end stage problems. It's the same sort of thing in the prison world where you're taking care of the end stage problems instead of the prevention on the front end or in any way affecting people's, let's say, their vitality, their emotions on the front end, so you don't get them spinning off into the criminal justice system or aging poorly. So I think a lot of this is the baby boomers who do not want to go weakly into the abyss and the dark like prior generations, where they sort of thought, well, you know, when I retire, I got a few more years, kick back, and then pretty soon my number's up. Now, I think people realize, wow, okay, I shift from one career, but I still feel vital in my 60s, 70s, 80s, and I still want to do something else.
Yeah. No, I'm often encouraging when people say, I'm retiring, and I go, yes, that you can say that to people just to, you know, simplify the conversation. But really what it means is you're available. And they're like, oh, yeah, that's what I mean. Right. So available. And working with Akaya Windwood and Bill McKibben, they have their whole movement called Third Act, which is for people over 60 engaging in social, you know, participatory dynamic for community good. Yeah, and also the value of a safe old age. What I learned from my animal companion, Stella Coyote, who lived to be 19 years, 2 months, 2 weeks, and 2 days. But as she as she aged, you know, it was always a wheel and deal with living with a coyote. I go, oh, Stella, now our deal is working out. I can give you something that nature would not, which is a safe old age and longevity. And as she aged in some senses diminished, but some other qualities of intelligence just really came alive, like just more intuitive, more psychic, more telepathic, more whatever. And I go, yeah, there's a lot. If we have a safe old age, there's a lot of unfurling intelligence to contribute to the community, right?
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. But it's also that age, the one thing really different compared to the young is you have experienced so many different things through historical sites. You know, when I think about it, I mean, I was born when Sputnik was launched, and now we're, you know, going to, we're landing on Mars, we're sending satellites to snoop around the moons of Jupiter. And when I grew up and my father worked in IBM, the plant was filled with unbelievable huge computers, which now the iPhone that literally every little kid has in their hand is infinitely more powerful. And if people would have said that to me when I was growing up, it would have sounded like science fiction. So yeah. To live through different times and experience them and then look back is very different than when you're very young and you can't even imagine the future, and considering that technology is actually speeding up because of the doubling rate, it's amazing what's going to happen. So
yeah,
I think that age definitely gives a certain benefit to that ability to sort of step back and go, well, you know, I went through that already, so let me help you out.
Right. And something also that my colleague Sean says is when our heartbeats are slow, time slows down. And when our heartbeats are fast, it speeds up. And I just think as part of, you know, your our, may it be so, dedication to insourcing our autonomy and our definition of things, you know, to, for everybody who insources their own autonomy, it kind of sucks the chi out of external authoritarianism, going, everybody self-possessed. And then all these ways to think about it, because you're working, I'm just so intrigued by everything that you wrote. Your friend Maria, who is a 77 yes. bikini competitor, personal trainer, and right. we can go more yeah. there. And then just all the, you know, how do we have our own steady rhythm? And are you a lifter of weights?
Yeah, I I've always been a bit of a jock, I have to admit. I mean, I was in junior high when Title IX, you know, was passed, and actually females could actually play in sports in high school, you know, against other interscholastic teams. And so in high school, I was volleyball, basketball, and track, you know, the first, let's say, female on those teams. It was the first time we had female teams. And in college, because of Title IX, and I was in a small third division college, Clark University in Massachusetts, I actually tried out for the male volleyball team and played on male collegiate volleyball. And so I've always been a bit of a jock. And I have to say that when people will ask me, how in the world did you spend 30 years in prison without, you know, getting depressed or stressed out or with all the things that happened to you, I always worked out before I hit the gym. And I actually got to the prison at 6:30 in the morning, but I was trained. Wow. I always got up at 4. You know, mind you, I went to bed early. I did like my sleep, so I was in bed at, you know, 8 or 9 o'clock at night. And I'd get up at 4, I'd go to the gym, work out, and then hit the prison at 6:30, and I was already like bright-eyed and bushy-tailed while all my poor nurses were slamming down coffee and eating a whole dozen donuts.
No, I think this is so important because to rewire, and I'm inspired to hear your own Saturn schedule rhythm going, okay, anything's possible. we might want a different word than jock, though. You were always a female Amazon, or whatever amuses you. Absolutely, you know. But yes, to have Saturn, you know, dedicated routine, right? And I think right now why it's so wonderful to host you here for all of our team, because we can all recalibrate now. It's sort of like a time out of time going, all right, everybody get ready to be their best selves and contribute to the world, because there's a lot of danger out there. So how do we calm down? And you know, and yeah, so you get up at 4, you go to bed at 8 or 9. I can almost imagine that. I can imagine that, you know.
See, I'm like, you know, like not have to have that schedule, I must admit, I wake up now at 5. So this is like,
that's very
like retirement. Well, you know, like, woo.
Well,
but,
you know,
my internal clock still gets me up early, and my greatest energy is actually in the morning. I think everybody has a circadian rhythm, but we're definitely wired to, let's say, wake up with the sun and go to sleep when it starts getting dark. You know, shift workers are really in a miserable state from a circadian rhythm and a health standpoint. You know, that really messes them up. The ones who work at nighttime and then sleep during the day, that wrecks them.
Right. And of course, the to be attuned to the, yes, when I was in California just 10 days or a week ago, something like that, I did get up at sunrise, and it's like, oh, this is great. I was in such a wonderful place to see the sunrise. It was like exciting, like being at the beach going, right. And I thought, I will aspire to take this back, you know, to the East Coast. And then, you know, okay, the old habits. No. But part of why Sean and I are giving this course is because we want to take this course. Right. And part of it is what you're inspiring in us too. So yeah. So you always worked out and went to the gym before you went to prison, and
went to the prison. Yeah.
Right.
And
yeah. No. That's
definitely. Oh, I was just going to say, when I had time off, like on the weekend, I would do hikes. I'd be out in nature as much as possible. And I live, you know, near, well, like 40 minutes from Lake Tahoe, which is really, you know, stunningly beautiful. But in my backyard, I can climb up into the, you know, hills and mountains. So I was always a hiker, too.
Your backyard, where we were, when we were booking this radio, you said you had 3 to 4 feet of snow and in the
right.
and
in front yard.
Right. Well, and it's melting. It's melted.
Yeah, actually, at my level, because I'm at like, well, 5,000, but I was actually sort of babysitting one of my friend's houses and her animals up in Incline Village, and she's a little bit above the lake level, and she still has 4 feet of snow in her yard, but it's, you know, dripping. And the higher you go up, there's still, of course, a ton more. It all has to do with elevation.
Right. But it's so crucial. I mean, all that you say, you know, it's like for us to reweave, you know, our action in the world with sensual, intimate connection with the larger world of nature of which we're a part. And that's the very specific kind of guidelines for, well, forever. But for now, you know, to be your woman storyteller out and about. And I love right now the moon in Leo backing you up. Its image is a community activist spreading her ideals, which is certainly you, right? And you wrote many things about which you're enthused. So I love you working with the Aging Gracefully. It's like I want to sign up. I want to sign up for your Wake Up with the Sun program, and for your Friend Maria program, and then for abolishing the death penalty program. You know, in order to be effective, it's so grand that way. And you know, incentivized by danger. You know, just something, you know, in our to and fro, I'm enthused to also interview your friend Pam Petch, launching her book Valentine's Day.
Really?
You said it's a beautiful.
Yeah,
because
love animals. You love animals, and this is a great animal story. And Pam Peck, you know, is a very good friend of mine, and I will tell your listeners that the one thing about, you know, getting to a certain age, because I'm pushing 70, is that you want to align yourself with people who may even be younger or older, but they have to be vital and relevant. Because, yeah, I mean, so you really look for the vitality, like Maria, who is my friend. And, you know, like competes, my God, you know, she actually a few years ago pulled me in to be in a bikini contest. And I won an Ultra Masters, which is the 60 to 70 year old group. Yeah, I won that in 2020 and in Las Vegas. So that was it. And I only did it out of what should I say? A lark, you know, like a curiosity. It's not exactly my thing to put on little sparkly, like, G-strings and prance around, but I thought, I want to do this once just to see what it's like. And I think stretching someone's comfort zone is a great way to grow.
Indeed, absolutely. And then, you know, we are negotiating, or I've extended the invitation to Pam Peck, you know, and it's her book, Puppies. It's based on the Puppies on Parole program that you had at Nevada State Prison.
Yeah, called Heart to Heart, Soul to Soul. Yeah.
Right. Well, this is also, you know, part of, you know, what do we encourage in others, in men and women, in the Mars woofiness in all of us. And so that's encouraging, you know, solicitude and responsibility, right? The prisoners tending for the doggies.
Absolutely. And I think anyone who loves animals realizes that unconditional love, animals seems to bond with humans, especially dogs and canines. And the impact on the prison was more than I expected, because it not only affected the inmates themselves, which was understandable, but it affected the custody officers too. In fact, one of the wardens, who was the last warden at, you know, this old prison that just shut down, is now a historical site, but he said the Puppies on Parole program started there, and he would tell me, he said, you know, when things got really dicey and violent, I basically took one of the dogs and walked around the units, and the units started calming down. And as a physician, I had to take care of, like, all the bad stuff that happened in the summers, like the jaw fractures and the stabbings and stuff. And the violence just dropped down and went through the floor when the dogs were being, you know, at that particular prison, at Nevada State Prison.
No, that's so great. It's another part of our Marself, our long, long relationship to wolves and then dogs and everything. And I love a friend saying, when Stella Coyote died, she said, the thing you will notice is the absence of energetic field, because dogs have a larger energetic field than humans. And I go, I think that could be true. Yeah, and then just the calming, the dog walking through. And as you said, the story, of course, is that bad dogs and people deserve a second chance. And it's hope, care, and love that change them, not shame and punishment, right? So you're in all these micro ways, you're really about transforming every part of culture, right? From punishment to healing, dynamic, here's the problem, what can we do, yeah?
Yeah, and I would say one of the big healing things that the dogs did for the inmates is the inmates, a lot of them never really felt one, unconditional love, but eyes that looked at them without judging them.
Yeah.
You see, and that really affected the inmates more than, and also the ability to touch something, that tactile, you know, communication, which in a prison is a no-no, you know, touching each other, which, you know, is, and humans are highly social animals. So, but to hug a dog is really helped them.
Yeah, I mean, it restores our field, right? And we're in the Beltane Taurus time that says, you know, everything is food to this part of us, you know, smell, taste, touch, you know, color, you know, and people can starve from deprivation of those things as much as anything. So yes, the embrace of the dog, and no dog has been harmed in this program.
Not that I know of. And then usually you would always hear the bad things in a prison. So no, I never heard that. And what's interesting is when the dogs first came in, the prison, of course, wanted to pick the best inmates. So, of course, it would be successful. And they picked lifers, men who would never leave the prison, who had been there for, you know, one or two, 3 decades, and had proven themselves as a guy who, let's say, paid attention to the rules, didn't get in trouble. You see what I mean? So mm-hmm. they were given the dogs first. And then there becomes, what should I say, the ethics of the prison, where it's like, okay, the person who would get a dog and then would be trained to be a dog handler is someone who raises the bar for everybody. And the inmates protected that program. So they would not tolerate an inmate, let's say, harming a dog. You see what I mean? There's this code of ethics that happens. And in
right.
fact,
and
there were, you know, bizarrely, there were some custody officers that maybe didn't like the program. But the inmates made sure that they didn't get pushed, like their little buttons pushed. They definitely. In fact, one dog, I don't know, had some sort of arthritic, I don't know, thing in its shoulder, and the inmates raised money to get the dog like a little surgery from a veterinarian so his shoulder could be okay. I mean, that's a little that was quite unusual, but that's what they did.
No, that's right. Well, this is all just changing the game that we're all invested in, what is rewarded and what is encouraged, and yeah, solicitude and kindness and companionship, and yes, all of those wondrous things. So I look forward to our show that will be dedicated to Pam's book and the work. And then you say that she adopted one of those dogs, Gabby.
Yeah, one. It's Gabby is a half pit and half shepherd, and is a loving dog, is a little skittish about males around Pam if the dog doesn't really know the male, you know, because it is protective, but a really great dog, and Pam loves it and travels with it. The doggy went from Reno, did a car trip to Arizona, you know, so, and poor Gabby had to, because Pam lives a bit higher, so they had tunnels, you know, where Gabby was like going through the tunnels to go out to poo and, you know, do their little dog thing, quite unusual for the dog, but yep, Pam loves that dog, and it inspired her to write the book.
No, it's so wonderful. It's also how we kind of recover from what passes for the news is just a couple of dog videos on dog rescues, things going, oh, there's the good part of humans that the dogs bring out. That's really super great. And then, you know, and then you're enthused now. I mean, we love that and look forward to Pam Peck on radio with her dog, prison book.
Yeah, thing about Pam, and that is Pam has been donating these books to a lot of children places because she really, really wants to promote the parent to read to the child because it's a beautiful book with beautiful illustrations, and she wants children and a lot of these kids who are in Big Brother, Big Sisters organizations, and they have a parent or somebody they know in prison, and they get the message that somehow they're bad and they're going to turn out bad. And she really wants to knock that down, that you may have had bad behavior at some time, but that there is this incredible ability to turn that corner. So she's donated a lot of books and is really into this program of helping children.
And what happens to the dogs? Do they go away? Is it a lifelong relationship to the prisoners?
No. So what happens, you know, actually the inmates actually are used really to train the dog so the dog is adoptable. The SPCA had real problems with pits and pit mixes because they were highly aggressive and not socialized. And, you know, people didn't really want them because they could be dangerous, especially with little kids and things like that. So and the SPCA in Nevada was a no-kill, you know, type zone. So they were like, God, what are we going to do with these dogs? And that was one of the ideas.
That's great.
Female prison, you know, female prison director came up with, because there are these programs in different prisons in different states. In fact, historically, it was started, I believe, in the state of Washington, and it was a nun who started it. And this nun had been a homeless female on the streets when she was a teenager, you know, really a bad sort of life. And then there was a big dog that she bonded with and protected her. And she said that dog helped her get over her, you know, mental issues and fear issues. And then she became a nun. And when she started helping in the prison in a female prison, she talked to the warden and said, and this is years ago, you know, said, Have you ever thought about how valuable dogs could be for helping women get over all their drama and trauma in their lives? Fortunately, he was progressive, tried it. It was such a hit that other prisons heard about it. And the last time I read, there were, I don't know, like 120 different programs like this sprinkled across the United States in different state prisons.
That's wonderful. We're going to take a very short musical break here. Our wonderful guest is Dr. Karen Gedney, and we will get back to our theme of redemption lies in brewing medicine for others and hanging out with dogs. And we'll be right back after this very short woof.
She shook the constellation and dazzled them across his eyes. She shook the constellations and dazzled them across his eyes. She showered his head with quasars and made his tallest cry.
Oh, get down.
Chanty, 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 come blow my chanty home. Ooh, chanty, 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 come blow my chanty home. Telegraph my indigo sky ship, make his voyage long.
Now get down.
Welcome back, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show. I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. With Sean Patrick O'Donohue, we'll be convening a Beltane virtual gathering on May 2nd, 3 p.m. Pacific Time, 6 p.m. East Coast Time, open to all by donation. More details, increasing details by the minute at coyotenetworknews.com. And it's the launch of our 8-week council, Celtic Trickster, Plants and Planets, Beltane to Summer Solstice, Courtship to Wedding. Again, coyotenetworknews.com for more information. Minute by minute, late breaking information. That's right. And our guest today, of course, is Dr. Karen Gedney. And you can find out more at website discoverdrg.com, right, full of all kinds of wonderful things that you're doing. So, yeah, redemption lies in brewing medicine for others. And just, you know, a reference to the first show we did, I guess it was a year and a half ago, but so powerful, you know, delineating, you know, 30 years in prison and then the crisis, the assault, you know, but you are the exemplar of, you know, turning trauma into dangerous, beautiful assignment, because you emerged from that, you know, really dedicated to improving the entire circumstance, right?
Yeah. Yeah. For your listeners, I mean, I was held hostage and assaulted and raped and concussion grenaded and all sorts of things. And then I still went back to work the next day. And, you know, some people, and it happened October Friday the 13th. I know you're interested in numbers and things like that.
Right.
I went back to work on Monday. And some people ask, well, why didn't you quit or walk away? And there's lots of different reasons, but I want to share something. And that is, I had spent my time in the prison trying to get across to my inmate population that no matter what had happened in their prior life, they always had the ability to look at it in a different way and not let it destroy them and use it to learn and go in a different direction. So it's sort of like, okay, here I am teaching that. I have to do that for myself. And I really got that wake-up call very early, because about 2 days after the hostage thing, the inmate who was killed, you know, when they got me out with the SWAT team, his mother called my office about 2 days later, and she said to me, oh, Dr. Gedney, I'm so sorry, but I'm so glad nothing happened to you. Because I didn't talk to the papers or the media or anything. And so she didn't know what really happened. And here's this poor lady. She had lost her husband. And the first thing that came out of my mouth was, well, nothing except he assaulted and raped me. And then she started crying, and I had this realization, wow, I am acting just like an inmate where I was hurt, and now I'm hurting someone else, you know, unintentionally or whatever. And so that was my wake-up call that I had to really pivot and, let's say, forgive not only the inmate who took me hostage and hurt me, but also the prison for, one, not protecting me, but also some in the prison who may have really wanted me hurt or dead or gone. They were those types. Mm. And then also, I did not want to be one of those women who are always traumatized because of one bad event. You know, I didn't want to be like that at all. So I turned it into a learning experience, and I ended up speaking on it for the new officers coming.
Oh, for the new officers coming in? Is that what you said?
Right, for the new officers coming in, yeah.
Right. It's a powerful narrative. I encourage everyone to read your book, 30 Years Behind Bars. What is it called? Actually, am I getting the wrong title?
Trials of a Prison Doctor. So it's 30 Years Behind Bars, Trials of a Prison Doctor. It seems that there's somebody else who has 30 years behind bars, but they meant like bars that where you drink at.
Oh, no.
Confuse that one.
right. No, it's right. I do encourage, because it was a powerful resonating book and a powerful resonating, like, because you have worked this and danced this. Although when you said, you know, yes, you hurt the mother of the person who had assaulted you and who had been killed.
Yeah, it wasn't, right.
Well, but it's an interesting theme to put on our work table, which is, you might have said it like, but nor did you infantilize her by not speaking truthfully.
It's one of those, it was just that when I heard her gasp and sob, I realized it was like I gut punched her. You know what I mean? I just blurted it out. And that's a tough one where I think you do have to let people know really the truth, but there can also be a better way of maybe delivering it.
Right. Well, that's exactly. We're all following your lead and guiding in that, right? Which is the manner of exchange. And you know, John O'Donohue, wonderful poet, but he like yourself, you know, extends insight and compassion to all of the team and has a beautiful poem. I'll see if I can find it to send it to you. But it's to the parents of one who has committed a terrible act. And it's reaching deep into, you know, the love way back, and it is the embrace. And I think that's just part of your wonderful, the woman storyteller heroine, excuse me, is interested in liberating women, liberating the land, liberating the entire circumstance, right? And that's why I love to call you a culture doctor. It's like liberating, because you really worked it, right? I mean, you really went in going, how did this happen? You know, and, you know, afterwards you said, I was the first person who looked at Moth, the person, and as Mars,
right,
and you as Venus, and seeing the story in a mythological light. Well, yeah, we want to know what forces are in play, or else we're possessed by them. And that's, you know, I think part of your dedication to cultural literacy programs and education programs, and that you, at that time, you know, expressed poignant, I don't know what the next word would be, but, you know, that the person, Moth, what a waste of his life, because he was a complex person.
Yeah, he was very complex, and, you know, part of me always wonders, if he hadn't been in Vietnam and what happened in Vietnam, which had definitely affected him emotionally, what he would have become. And the sheriff in Carson City, where all of this took place, was the one who was called in on the hostage, and he was Moth's best friend. They were childhood friends. And he later talked to me and said, you know, we were a group of kids, and half became cops and half became criminals, which is sort of interesting to me. You know, why
movies about
one
that
would go one way and one the other. You know what I mean?
Right. Well, and I think, you know, much of your dedicated life is addressing that. I honor the work of Ed Tick, who's worked with Vietnam vets and veterans returning from all wars. And one of the vets he was working with said, you know, Americans are hiring us to do horrible things so they can feel good about themselves. And we go, right, okay, we want to dive deeply. And, you know, he works with them, you know, he says, you know, returning vets, which is, it's all part of the story, right? And he says the Odyssey is a manual for how you integrate veterans. It takes 12 years of these things, you know. And again, for lack of the ritual, it becomes literalized. And I think when I sometimes work with a forensic psychiatrist, and our conversation is, she says, there is no strictly private crime. It's all a collective dream in some way, and speaking to all of us about what needs to be healed. And you've certainly worked and teased it into that realm, going, you know, this is a real ordeal that you went through and emerged. But then your questions like, well, how does this speak to us? All the stories, right? All stories lead us to all stories. The violence of the Vietnam War and the thing, and the it's like poet Yohei Labavidi says, you can't expect to bury pain and not have it grow roots, right? So So your endeavor to bring, you know, educational opportunities and as we were speaking, even mythological literacy possibly to prisons, where is that standing now, or what are you most ardent about?
Well, as you mentioned to your people who are listening, I'm involved with what's called Nevada Prison Education Project, and it's a group of people who, one, are hooked with the universities, the community colleges, as well as people that are affiliated with the prison, people like me who have taught in the prison for a long time, who still want to, you know, be helpful or teach again. And, of course, COVID threw everything, you know, off the walls. Now, Nevada recently has had a shift in prison directors, and this prison director has gone on, let's say, the record for saying that he's willing to open it to organizations that can help the inmates, which is like something that's really new for Nevada. And he even said, and if someone is an ex-felon who also wants to help and volunteer, and, you know, has a clean, you know, record on the outside, I will welcome them too, which was something that was an absolute no in the past, you know, any ex-felon coming back into a prison. So we're trying to, let's say, help with the coordination between the outside colleges and the prison, and all of this is just getting in motion, let's say, at the present moment. But I do have high hopes that this prison director can pull it off. The one thing that's really a problem is staffing. Nevada, because of COVID and officers leaving and who knows and whatever else going on, they had literally 65% of the staff in the prisons being insufficient, right? So that you can't really function like a prison, and especially if you want to bring programs in. So in Nevada, the legislators are in gear. And since I live in Carson City, it's a very strange state because Carson City is a small city, but it's the capital. And then you're aware of different bills coming forward. And so I can actually go, I can look at the legislative things coming up, and I can actually go and speak to certain things at the legislature. The last time I was there was, I don't know, maybe 2 weeks ago or so, when they were having a bill trying to change the rules on solitary confinement, because Nevada is notorious for having had, you know, guys for years, decades in solitary confinement. So that was being pushed. And I never know, you know, how much is helpful or not. But when I see certain things where my voice may make someone a bit more aware, when I said what I said on solitary confinement, one of the state senators, that's a legislative senator, he actually came up to me and said, "Man, 30 years in prison. I don't know. I've never met anyone who had 30 years in prison." He said, "You know, you should write a book." I said, "By the way, I did write a book." And he said, "Okay, I'm going to get it." I said, "Well, once you read it, then, you know, contact me if you have questions," because he's someone who legislation about prisons come up to these legislators, but they don't really know prisons. You see what I mean? Right. So he was curious enough to actually reach out to me, which is, like I said, it's a small state. So sometimes you can get some things done just by speaking up and being in the right place.
That's so great.
Time.
Yeah. Well, no, I love that your ministry really is those imprisoned, the family of those imprisoned, those legislators who are imprisoning them. You know, it's all, as you say, restoring intimacy through information, like, "Oh, I didn't know that," you know, and guiding the, you know, "Here's a dog and here's a book." And so much, you know, from even your Twitter feed, which is just reframing from punishment to healing and redemption. Such a huge necessary cultural shift, you know. Nathaniel Hawthorne said, "Beware the impulse to punish," right? Which we can then all explore in our own micro hearts too. Going, when do we like? What is it? And how do we, you know, micro model that? You know, and so you're an always learning person, yet.
Yeah? Yes, I have a fascination with learning, and I learn all sorts of different things. Like sitting in front of me is like the Scientific American and the Discovery magazine. And, you know, I love to just learn new things. And sometimes I feel that I'm getting pulled in a little bit too many directions at one time. But I like to tell people that to really do well in life, I look at it as one, you have to always maintain your curiosity instead of just jumping to things, and two, compassion, where you look at what you can do to improve suffering in yourself or in others, and then collaboration. It's like the three C's. That's how I look at life, and it's sort of fun now because I'm not so laser focused inside the prison all the time, that I belong to different odd organizations and networking groups, and I never know who I run into or what kind of impact I can have, or share my book, you know, with people. One of the things I am poor at is I am not attached to social media in terms of, there's a lot of people who are like, "Okay, Karen, you got to be Facebook and Instagram and Twitter and this and that." And that's just not really me. I'm more.
No, that's great.
I'm just more of word of mouth, and it's of course, I'm not looking at it as a business. You know, some people really are into that because they're just promoting a business. I have to, you know, this is just weird, but like last year, I got certified as an elite mentor trainer in the Peter Sage organization. And then this year, I became certified in hypnotherapy. You know, I just increased my odd skills. And like the personal trainer lady who's my friend, she said to me, "Oh, Karen, I'm training this 70-year-old woman, but she just can't give up her two glasses of wine a night. And she wants to, but she doesn't know how." And I mentioned you were certified in hypnotherapy. Can you try? And I'm like, sure. So I'll be, you know, trying that out.
And no, I love that.
I feel like I'm like an eclectic little traveler, just seeing what sticks, right?
Right. I'm gazing at your chart now just because I can't help myself, because you are so dream, you're weird, your moon in Sagittarius, power of the woman, storyteller, which is what you say, cast net of curiosity widely, different everything, you know, haul it in, edit it, because you it squares Jupiter and Virgo. So it's like you're interested in everything deeply, in a detailed way, and finding use for it in some form. So yeah, just to mantra, yeah, curiosity, compassion, collaboration, right? You know, so it's extend net of curiosity widely, inhale, edit, I like this from here, but not that, you know, collage, and then put it out again, which is what you're doing, and to give fresh expression and translate things across borders. It's so admirable. And it does, it's all connected, right? So you left the literal building prison is not your daily assignment anymore, right? But you are addressing with others as an elite mentor trainer and hypnotherapist the many forms of prison, right?
Definitely breaking down those walls. I think everyone has different prison walls or bars that limit them from things they potentially want but don't have the ability yet to break out of those restrictions.
Right. And again, you're brewing, you know, action, informed action with larger compassion, empathy, and what shall we do? And, you know, it's like you are such an alert person, you know, as though you notice more, think more, observe more per minute or inch than many people, which is, I mean, I'm offering this to you as a possibility, but because then at a certain point you get to go full and then pull back into taking a hike or nature or two.
Right. Yeah, back. No, I mean, I definitely believe in self-care. So, you know, I spent years being a bit sleep deprived, being on call as a doctor to prisons. And now I really, really enjoy my like seven, eight hours of sleep a night. In fact, let me think, May 5th, my friend Maria is giving a wellness talk to a bunch of people. And she said, "Okay, Karen, can you speak on the medical value of sleep and the medical value of meditation and also the future of medicine?" You know, I have three little topics. And so I put together a little slideshow, which is more a visual slideshow, and then I throw the storytelling. I don't like slides with a lot of data on them.
Those are disem PowerPoint presentations, right?
Right. So I have pictures. You know, in the prison, I could only really teach with storytelling to make an impact on the inmates. Because I didn't have PowerPoint ability in the prison at all, so that didn't work.
Right, but it has been an impact, but it's also a long unfurling influence, right? I mean, behind you and before you, wherever you've gone, you've left things that are influencing the structure and dissolving the cruelty. Dissolving cruelty. I think that's part of what you've been up to, right? Dissolving cruelty and having a long-lasting influence.
Yeah. I mean, I have I think it's, I have always had an issue with abuse of power. Yes. That's where I have issues with. And I think part of it growing up, my mother grew up in Germany as a young girl. And, you know, hearing stories about the Nazis and of course, her survival and then Russian prison war camps. And then the stories that I heard later in life where, you know, you're older and you can, I was pulling out stories from my mother about people who were decent in the worst of times. And, of course, people who were scoundrels when things were better. You know, I still remember her saying that she was a Flüchtling, which means, you know, a refugee with her family, because they were on the side of Germany, which they, after the war, went to Poland. So they didn't have a country anymore or a home or anything, and nobody wanted them. So they're like refugees sitting in barracks. And the American Red Cross would get supplies, but the churches who were, I don't know, sort of ferreting who got what, the head church people just sold everything on the black market, so they were starving, you know. So, you know, I, when I would listen to these stories of abuse in places you wouldn't necessarily think. Here you have the American Red Cross, then the churches are helping, but it's the people in the churches that are the scoundrels. You see what I mean?
Yeah. No, we're on our way out. We're on our way out all too soon. But thank you always in perpetuity, Dr. Karen Gedney, for, yes, all we have to do is transform the entire human cultural interface of how we engage with everything. You're doing a wonderful, dedicated work. All woofy blessings to you, the path unfurl and that you be replenished by all the good that you do in the world. Thank you so much, Dr. Karen Gedney.
Well, and thank you for giving me the opportunity, and I know you'll enjoy my friend Pam
yes,
Peck.
Exactly. So discoverdrg.com and also is for Dr. Karen Gedney and also coyotenetworknews.com for more ways to play. I'm Caroline Casey. Thank you always, Kirsten Thomas, and we will reconvene next week with Rachel Harris.